Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for once again joining us as we are continuing to go plowing through the big old monster box of baseball cards. The sets, the stacks of cards getting smaller and smaller as we go year by year, set by set, because much like you, I got rid of a lot of these cards from the early 90s. They're not worth that much, but it is nice to go looking back through some of these sets, and we're going back through 1991. This week, taking a look at the 91 Upper Deck set, another classy, great set put out by the people of Upper Deck, and in my opinion, really the last year that Upper Deck just controlled the hobby, because going into 1992, everybody else figured out, okay, we've got to step up our game here, because you had Stadium Club, which came out. We'll talk about that in an upcoming podcast. You had Leaf that had been out for a couple of years, and Upper Deck was no longer the premium baseball card set. Certainly in 91, you started getting more competition, but by 1992, the competition was overwhelming. Everybody tried to be just like Upper Deck, but for one last shining season, Upper Deck still ruled the roost, and they came out with another great card set. A random pull for this podcast is card number 61, one of the top prospects from the 91 Upper Deck set, Royce Clayton, who had a pretty nondescript career, especially for a first-round draft pick. He had a lengthy career, but nothing that really stood out. He didn't have a spectacular career, but you may actually know Royce Clayton more for his work in the arts than what he's done in baseball. Like I said, he had a lengthy career. He certainly had a serviceable one, but he didn't really stand out amongst a lot of other players, certainly shortstops in his lengthy career. So we'll talk about his career, what he's doing now, or what he did late in his career, which you may actually know him more for. And of course, we'll take a peek at the 91 Upper Deck set. What made that set so special, even though in many ways it was much of the same from previous sets released in 1990 and 1989. First, let's take a look at what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We're open 24/7. We encourage you to not only respond to our podcast, talk about some of the players that we talk about or some of the card sets we talk about, but really just talk about anything in the hobby. And we've had a lot of people just posting card breaks they've had, deals that they've found with some of the sets that we've talked about in previous podcasts, and a lot of fun stuff being discussed here, including throwback uniforms. This is something I brought up in our previous podcast on 91 Score, and it sparked what sparked the conversation was the random poll was Sammy Sosa, and Sosa is pictured in the Turn Back the Clock 1917 Chicago White Sox uniform, which the White Sox wore in a game in the final season of Comiskey Park in 1990. So I asked, what was your favorite throwback uniform? And we had some pretty interesting ones in the last podcast. We've got a few more that have come in, including from Matt Aber, who is based in Philadelphia, pretty much anything powder blue, though biased towards Phillies. And of course, you're based in Philadelphia, so I would thoroughly and truly expect that. It's funny how powder blue has come back. People actually like it now, and it looks cool. I don't know, maybe HDTV has something to do with it. Maybe hip-hop music has something to do with it, because that really got the throwback apparel and merchandise industry going about 10, 15 years ago. So I'm not really sure how the powder blue got back into popularity, especially because I remember when it was phased out in the mid to late 80s. Like I said, I think the Blue Jays were the last team. Well, not the Blue Jays, no, the Royals. The Royals wore powder blue through, I think, 1990, maybe 91. I may be off a year there. But the Royals and the Expos were the last teams to wear the powder blue. I know the Expos got rid of it after 91. And by then, if you had powder blue, they didn't actually call it powder blue. They called it baby blue. You know, it was almost denigrating. It was just like, oh, look at you. You're dressed up in this cute little jumper. Yeah, the blue got very unpopular, laughably unpopular, and teams ditched it for the more classy, cleaner gray road uniforms. And it finally just came back, like I said, 10, 12 years ago or so, and you're seeing more and more teams willingly wearing the powder blue throwbacks, including more colorful road jerseys or alternate jerseys. And you're also seeing it In fullback jerseys, which we've seen here in Tampa Bay, a jersey that Joe Maddon actually helped design when he was manager here a few years ago. Had the Tampa Bay Rays existed in, say, 1978, they, you know, what kind of uniform would they be wearing? And you see it every now and then. They don't wear it as often as they used to. But basically, if the 78 Brewers and 78 Padres uniforms had a love child, that's what it would look like. So even in these fantasy throwback jerseys, powder blue has come back. So I don't know why, because I remember when I was a kid watching the powder blue get phased out, I was happy because it wasn't very popular, but now it has really come back with a vengeance. And one of my favorite powder blue jerseys, Joey W., our Braves fan, notes, my favorites are the Braves baby blues, and I love this poster back in the day. And he sent us a picture of the poster with Dale Murphy wearing the early to mid-80s Braves road uniform. And he's standing in a dark alley, and he's got a bat that's been dipped in some kind of nuclear liquid here. You know, I guess it's supposed to be a lightsaber kind of effect here, but it looks like it kind of fell into the Chernobyl pits. But it says Power Alley, and, you know, Dale Murphy's swinging around this lightsaber bat, basically. It's a Nike ad, and I love that jersey. In fact, I've said it 1,000 times in this podcast. I was a Blue Jays fan when I was a kid, and I didn't really care for the Atlanta Braves. The Braves were not a very good team when I was growing up. Before there was baseball, you know, Major League Baseball in the regular season in Florida, you had a lot of Braves fans, but they were kind of casual Braves fans until 1991. Suddenly, everybody was wearing Braves stuff and cheering on the Braves. Imagine that. So, you know, I never really cared for the Braves, never really cared for the bandwagon fans in the early 90s. Being a Blue Jays fan at the time, defeating the Braves in the World Series in 1992 was just a beautiful thing. But that throwback jersey from the early to mid 80s, I love it so much. I actually bought one from eBay. And, you know, I kind of went on this little jersey spree over the last year or so. Not that I have tens of thousands of them, but I bought four or five. And one of them was the Dale Murphy throwback jersey that is actually in this poster. And I love it. It's one of my favorites, not only because it looks good, but even though as much as I could care less for the Braves in the 1980s and certainly in the 90s, Dale Murphy was one of my favorite players to watch. He was consistently the only good player on a lot of those Atlanta Braves teams. Now, you had Glenn Hubbard, you had Bob Horner, you had some decent pitchers too. I mean, Phil Niekro was still somehow chucking those knuckleballs over the plate, you know, in his early 40s with the Braves. And you had a couple of decent players here and there. But the Braves were never, except for 1982, they were just never able to really completely put it all together. Put on a good run in 84, you know, battled with the Padres for the division lead. But Dale Murphy was the one consistent guy for the Atlanta Braves throughout the 1980s. And I always respected that, always respected that. And having the retro replica jersey that is pictured in this poster, it is one of my absolute favorites. Let's see, a couple other thoughts about throwback jerseys from Steve Ballman. I've always liked the Padres and A's uniforms of 70s and early 80s, or maybe I just have a soft spot for gold. And he has a picture of a 74 Topps Reggie Jackson card with the gold Oakland Athletics top and a 1980 Topps Ozzie Smith card wearing the 79 road uniforms, which the Padres had the gold sleeves with the brown chest and back. And, you know, gold is kind of like powder blue. It's one of those, you know, powder blue is a lot more subtle than gold. I mean, gold just really pops out at you. You can't really miss it. So something about gold has come back as well. And again, maybe it's HDTV. Maybe it just looks better on television now. But I agree with you. The gold really stands out. And while I always kind of had this diversion from powder blue, gold I've always liked. And of course, me being a hockey fan, loving the Vancouver Canucks sweaters from the early 80s, the home sweaters where they wore gold. I've always liked the Golden State Warriors, you know, whenever they would wear a gold color jersey at home. I was never a Lakers fan, but there's something very cool about the Lakers their shade of gold, you know, having that as a home jersey. So gold somehow works. It wasn't as, people weren't as turned off by gold as they were with powder blue. Although when you often paired it up with Padre Brown, people would get turned off by it. And speaking of Padre Brown, Robbie T86, also known as Booby Maine, so many great ones to choose from, but I'd have to go with these. And he's got a picture of the 84 Padres, Steve Garvey giving the thumbs up, standing next to Tony Gwynn and a couple other teammates. And I mentioned this before, even though I never cared for the Padres, and certainly not that particular jersey, the ones that they wore on the road in the early 80s, well, even I succumbed to that. Yeah, I've bought one of those as well. And it's just one of those things where the colors popped out a little bit. At first, I think people saw them as ugly, but over time, people grew to like them once again. And there are many factors again, but somehow, some way, people have found their way back to the simpler yet complex colors in some of the road jerseys from the 70s and 80s, be it powder blue or Padre gold and brown, or the tequila sunrise look with the Houston Astros. And I mentioned, you know, these colors look a lot better on HDTV. TV, in particular color TV, is one of the big reasons why teams experimented with all these wacky colors in the 70s. Of course, it starts with Charlie Finley and the Kansas City Athletics in 1963. And that was really less TV and more just trying to get some attention for a really mediocre team. You know, the A's, even though they'd only been in Kansas City for maybe 8 or 9 years at that point in time, they were just an average team. They were essentially a farm club for the Yankees. You know, every good player that they got, they'd trade to the Yankees. The fan base was starting to dwindle a little bit. They're playing in the old Municipal Stadium. They're not really getting any attention. Finley was already trying to move the team to cities like San Antonio, and he wasn't getting anywhere there. I think Dallas, he was going to try to move into Texas shortly after the Colt 45 started in 1962. So he wasn't getting any attention. He wasn't getting what he wanted by moving to a bigger city with a better facility. So he dressed up the team in green and gold, and boy, he got attention. All of a sudden, the A's were a flashy team, and everybody kind of mocked the uniforms. But it made a very mediocre team stand out. You could not miss the Kansas City A's, especially if the lights went out. You always knew where the Kansas City A's were because of their green and gold color scheme, but most notably because they wore gold on the road. So they were represented very well with that color scheme. Well, while Finley was doing it more for promotional purposes, by the late 60s, teams started getting the idea of changing up color schemes for color television. And I believe one of the first teams to do a dark blue or a powder blue road jersey was the Chicago White Sox. I think it was 1969, maybe 68, when they started it. They were one of the first teams to make that switch. And then, of course, in 1969, the Montreal Expos come in. They've got the blue road uniforms. Shortly thereafter, the Seattle Pilots, almost forgot about them, the Pilots had a blue uniform in 1969. And then shortly after that, the Royals went with a blue uniform. The Padres would go with an all-gold home uniform. The Houston Astros, before Tequila Sunrise, had a very bright orange uniform, very bright orange hats. They never had a full orange uniform. The Orioles did, as we mentioned in our previous podcast. And it's all because of color television. By 1971, 72, more and more Americans were buying color TV. So baseball owners trying to make their teams stand out, much like Charlie Finley, who they mocked. Well, then all of a sudden they're doing the same thing. You know, they decided to change up color schemes and make their teams stand out. And color television is pretty much to blame for some of the truly awful uniforms that we saw in the 70s and 80s. But again, maybe it's partially because of HDTV that these color schemes are coming back and fans are falling in love with them once again. Now, one more throwback uniform, and this is the exact opposite of the tacky Padres and A's and Astros and all those other teams we brought up. Jason Carter says, can't go wrong with the Reds home whites from the 1970s through about 1990. Clean and simple. And he includes a picture of the 1990 Cincinnati Reds, not the whole team, but you have Lou Piniella facing towards the camera, and around him, two players on each side, from left to right, Paul O'Neill, Barry Larkin, Chris Sabo, and Eric Davis. So presumably the 1990 Cincinnati Reds here. It is a great photograph, and it really underlies that simplicity works just as well, if not in some cases better, than complex uniforms. And if it wasn't for the Yankees and their pinstripes, I would have to say the Reds would be right up there with classic uniforms. You could argue that the Dodgers would be maybe number two, because the Dodgers have had that Dodger blue and Dodger script with very few tweaks since 1938. So you would have the Yankees, you would have the Dodgers, the Red Sox as well. Red Sox, with the exception of a few years in the 1970s, have kept pretty much the same look over the years. Even the Cubs, you know, the Cubs have, you know, they had blue road uniforms. They had the pajama road uniforms in the late 70s. They've changed things up a little bit. But Cincinnati, the Reds have, for the most part, kept the same look. And of course, the look that Jason's referring to is the big red machine look from the 1970s. In fact, they had this look in general since, I think, 68, right up till 92. And really, the only difference from the early 60s to the early 90s was they had the double knit pullovers that most people are familiar with, not the button down jerseys. And for the Reds, you know, you mentioned, Jason, that it was a clean and simple look, and you're right, but it's also classy. And if anybody knows anything about those Reds teams from certainly the mid 70s, but even the 1990 team, they were not altar boys. There were some party animals. They weren't as well known as the Bronx Zoo Yankees from the late 70s, but there were some party animals here. And never mind Pete Rose. I mean, there were actually quite a few well-known players who did not shy away from the party life during the team's glory days. And still, despite the fact that this was not the, you know, prim and proper team of Major League Baseball, they looked that way because of such a clean and simple look. And this actually goes back to something, a little bit of a sidebar here with college football. Now, I'm an alum of the University of Alabama, and if you look at Alabama's football uniforms, they are the cleanest, simplest uniforms in all of college football. I truly believe that. Now, I'm not just saying this because I'm an alum of the school, but I truly believe that they've got the simplest football jersey that they have not monkeyed with. They've had basically the same jersey since the 1950s, really. I mean, it's basically a Bear Bryant-era uniform that is still being utilized to this day. And I have a lot more respect for the college football teams that stick with one look. And it's not just Alabama. You've seen it with, I mean, just look at some of the top teams in the nation right now. You've seen it with Michigan. You've seen it with Clemson. You know, I know Clemson mixes in a purple uniform every now and then. I'm not crazy about that. Washington, the Huskies have kept pretty much the same look for many, many years. But sticking with one look, one theme, one color scheme, one feel, there's a little more class to that than I think all these other schools who put out like 8 football uniforms for one season. You know, when you have to put out a schedule that says, okay, this Saturday we're wearing this helmet and this shirt and these pants and these shoes, so you should wear this shirt, you're overthinking it. You're overdoing it just a tad. In fact, a lot of these football teams, here's a fun activity for you to do. Look at some of the college football teams that have come out with multiple uniform combinations in a year and see if that team has more uniforms than wins. I guarantee you, 90% of the schools that mix and match uniforms every other week, they have more uniform combinations than wins. And you look at the teams that have 8, 9, 10 wins, they keep it pretty simple. And that's something that I like, you know, certainly with college football, but even going back to baseball, the Reds, a very classy look for many, many, many years. All right, moving on from the uniforms very quickly, some thoughts about some cards here. Waxpack 916 bought some 86 Donruss cello packs. He got 5 cello packs for $20 shipped. Very nice. He says it's a great set, a lot of rookie cards so far. Pulled the crime dog, my good buddy Fred McGriff. Good job there. And he sends us a picture of some of the cello packs, or the rack packs, I should say. And I did mention way back in our 86 Donruss podcast, which is a while ago, who did we have as a random pull? Hubie Brooks, that's right. I mentioned that even though this was not a big dollar set in terms of cards, with the exception of the Jose Canseco card, you could still find that, buy it, sell it for a few dollars. Even though it is not a big dollar set for a 30-year-old set, it is a very sharp set and pretty good star selection there. Alex Hyde, in response to Wax Pack 916, check out what a coworker gave me for helping me with a project. It's a factory sealed 85 tops wax box. What? I want to talk to that coworker. I've got some work for him. I mean, if you're paying me an 85 tops wax boxes, you got to be kidding me. 91 score, which was the focal point of our last podcast. We had, first of all, some very kind comments from our friends at Cardboard Clubhouse, best card-related podcast out there. Thank you very much. Even little comments like that make you know that, A, somebody is listening, and B, whoever's listening likes the podcast. So I really appreciate it. Seth Poho, 91 baseball card set, gives fans a historical record of the first turn back the clock game. Yep. As I mentioned, that particular uniform that the White Sox wore in 1990, that really got the turn back the clock shtick going, as teams started to, and they would do it maybe once a year, they would go back into the archives and dig up some old uniform. But then, like I said, really about 15, 20 years ago, it just got moving. And now you have teams that have, you know, a home jersey and an away jersey, but they may have two or three alternate jerseys that are simply throwback uniforms. And fans love it. Fans absolutely love it. One last thought from Ben Adams. I'd like to go on the record as saying I want more Harry Carey on the podcast. Hashtag ASOS, which refers to my story in the last podcast about how when Sammy Sosa was with the Cubs, Harry Carey would mention at least once a game that if you spelled Sosa backwards, you got ASOS. And, you know, it dawned on me, Ben, Harry passed away. This upcoming February, it will be 19 years, which is hard to believe. And it dawned on me that if you're somebody who is 25 years old, and most of our listeners are older than 25, you kind of fall in the 25 to 45 age range, at least based on some of the analytics I've looked at with our podcast. If you're 25 years old, you're probably too young to remember Harry Carey as a broadcaster. And even though, you know, most people recall Harry Carey for the ASOS type stories or, Will Ferrell's impression of him on Saturday Night Live, it was a treat to listen to Harry Carey because the Cubs for many, many, many years were not that good. And really the only highlight was listening to Harry Carey. And in his later years, the main reason why you listen to Harry Carey, other than, you know, to ignore the fact that the Cubs were just a crappy team, was he was just so entertaining. And, you know, he was such a diehard Cubs fan by the end of his life that, you know, he really bled blue for the Cubs for the final, what was it, about 15 years that he called Cubs games before he died. And I got to tell you, Harry Carey, it was funny the chemistry he had with Steve Stone, because Harry, by the end of his time, you know, he was just kind of a little bit of a loose cannon. I mean, he always was, really, but, you know, he was just kind of letting it go by then. And Steve Stone was trying so hard to be the straight-laced guy. And I remember one game, Suzanne Summers, very attractive actress, model, 1970s. This would have been like maybe 91, 92, something like that. For some reason, she was throwing out the first pitch at Wrigley Field. And back then, Suzanne Summers had just started marketing the Thighmaster, which I think she still does these days, a little exercise device that, you know, you jam between your legs, strengthens your thighs. Well, she was just starting to do that back then. And for some reason, she's throwing out the ceremonial first pitch at Wrigley Field. And it's in the middle of the summer. The wind is blowing in a little bit. And Suzanne Summers is wearing this nice, summer dress, basically. And she throws the pitch, and the wind blows up her dress just a tiny bit, not like over her head, but, you know, shows quite a bit of leg. And that's it. Nothing more. Just shows quite a bit of leg. And Harry goes, "Whoa! Did you see that, Steve? That Thighmaster must really work." Of course, Steve Stowe's like, "Well, Harry's starting pitcher for the Atlanta Braves is Greg Mannix, and he comes in with a 5-2 record." You know, he's just trying to just keep things going. But, you know, he's just rattling off numbers of the starting pitcher, and Harry's like, "She's just incredible. Just look at her." It's just classic Harry Carey there. So I can't guarantee Harry Carey every podcast there, Ben, but anytime that I can mix him in, I will gladly do it. All right, let's take a look at the 91 Upper Deck set. Again, our random pull card number 61 from the top prospect subset. Royce Clayton, shortstop for the San Francisco Giants. We'll talk about him in a little bit. Let's take a look at the 91 Upper Deck set, which had a very classic look to it, classic in the sense of Upper Deck. Of course, this was only their third set. And a lot of the same elements that you saw in 1989 and 1990, you saw again in 1991. Some great photography, clean, crisp, clear photography. Now, here's Royce Clayton in a stage shot here in spring training. But they had a lot of action shots, a lot of beautiful full-color shots, and that was a hallmark for Upper Deck for many, many, many years. And they continue to have that great photography. The white borders on the outside of the card started getting a little thinner. You started seeing the movement to having pretty much entirely all picture on a card and not as much borders. Now, you know, you compare the 91 Upper Deck to 89 Upper Deck, you'll see the difference. 89 Upper Deck is everybody, as much as everybody says, "Wow, that was such a revolutionary set." And in many ways it was. It had more and more border space than most people remember. It's actually a very closed front design, really. But you start seeing it in 91. It starts opening up a little bit. And another feature that you see in 91 is the base path feature. And I brought this up during our 89 Upper Deck podcast, where in 89, you had a baseline going up the right side of the card. So basically the first baseline. In 90, the baseline ran across the top of the card to the upper left-hand corner. So essentially setting up for second base. Well, here in 91, you have the baseline going down the left side. And what looks like third base is basically the position of the player. And then the baseline goes across the bottom, and there is a home plate in the lower right-hand corner. Now, for most cards, on the home plate is the team logo. But because this was part of the Top Prospect subset, you had the Top Prospect logo in there, which Upper Deck created, which has kind of this military look to it, actually. But you had that instead of the team logo there. But you notice where the player's name is at the bottom. That is essentially the dirt path along the third baseline. And in fact, you could say the far left-hand corner is like the coach's box. So again, they're continuing with this theme of the baseball field, which would stop in 1992. But, you know, they quite literally covered all the bases in 89, 90, and 91. So you've got home plate, which is where the team logo, or in this case, the Top Prospect logo would be. Third base, which is where the position is, and then basically where second base is, you have the Upper Deck logo. So a complicated front, but a very simple one and very clean. And again, a lot of it is due to the beautiful photography that they got, the great quality photography, and then also the cardstock, the gloss that they had to the cards. Not extremely glossy, but just, you know, the nice, clean card production process that Upper Deck introduced in 1989, continuing in 91. And, you know, this is something, even though there are a lot of the same elements from the previous 3 years, once again in 91, keeps the bar high for Upper Deck. Flip the card over on the back. Now, normally, in the case of the Royce Clayton card here, you've got this little scouting report. Normally, there would be a player picture in there. But again, because this was a special subset, they do a little scouting report to tell you why they selected this guy as a top prospect. And then on the left side of the card, you've got the player's stats. In this case, it's a pro stat, just one line for his time in San Jose. And then in the upper left-hand corner, you got the card number, you've got the Major League Baseball and the Players Association logos, and then you have the hologram, which was in a home plate shape in 1991. And again, the holograms have become problematic for collectors. Back then, it was meant to prevent counterfeiting, and it was also to be a nice little extra bell and whistle to an already pretty classy product here. Well, 25 years later, those holograms are peeling off, so it's harder and harder for collectors to get true gem mint cards from the 91 Upper Deck set, or really any Upper Deck set from the first 5 or 6 years, because the stickers are flaking off. The foil has flaked off after all these years. So with good intentions, they put it up there, but all these years later, it's actually starting to become detrimental to the value and the desirability of the set. Now, an interesting note about this particular card, again, there's a scouting report here for Royce Clayton, and when you read it, you know, it's giving him all these plaudits about, you know, he bypassed college, the Giants were paying for his education, he was an absolute stud in San Jose, da-da-da-da-da. Well, you scan on down to the very last sentence here, it says, "Few questions remain regarding his defense, but he still needs to cut down on his strikeouts." So a slightly brutally honest scouting report here on the back of the 91 Upper Deck card. He had 98 strikeouts and 460 at-bats. So, okay, there's an argument there. And he did strike out quite a bit as a player, but a little harsh calling him out for that. And the ironic thing is when it comes to his offense, you look at his career in the major leagues, and as I've said before, it was a very lengthy career, very serviceable career, even though it wasn't a spectacular one, 17 years in the big leagues. From an offensive standpoint, he was actually a pretty decent player. He had a career batting average of .258, so good, not great. Did strike out 1,415 times in 8,164 plate appearances. So you're looking at once every almost six times at bat. So yeah, he did cut down in his strikeouts a little bit, but that was a somewhat persistent problem in his career. He never led the major leagues in strikeouts, but there are several points in his career where he had over 100, a career worst 125 while in Colorado in 2004. But offensively, this guy was actually pretty good. Defensively is really what kind of hampered him from being a superstar. He played almost exclusively at shortstop in his career, and he had a career fielding percentage of 97.4%. So again, that's average, but certainly not in a gold glove range or even a consistent all-star range. Had he gotten over 980 or 985, I think people would have paid more attention to him. But with that career average at 974, it kind of took away from all the other good things that he did in his career. Now, he was an all-star once in 1997. He had a 973 fielding percentage back then, but really he was known more for his offensive outburst than he was hitting .266. Also stole 30 bases. He had quite a bit of speed, especially early on in his career. And he was one of the lone standouts for a Cardinals team that also, much like Royce Clayton, was good but not great. Now, he was certainly great coming out of high school. He played at St. Bernard High School in Playa del Rey, California. The Giants, not that far away, kept an eye on him and made him a first-round pick in the 1988 draft. They were able to convince him to finish school while he was training to become a professional ball player, made his major league debut late in the 1991 season, and from then on, he would have a pretty serviceable career. Became a regular shortstop in 1993 on the Giants team that won 103 games, but still did not win the National League West, as the Atlanta Braves won 104 games that year. But he had a pretty good career in San Francisco, but then got traded to the Cardinals after the 1995 season. December 14th, 1995, traded along with a player to be named later. That would be Chris Wimmer, who was a career minor leaguer, to St. Louis for Doug Creek, Rich DeLucia, Alan Watson thrown into that package as well. Really kind of a wash on that deal there. He would spend two and a half seasons in St. Louis, got traded to Texas. Let's see. At the trade deadline, July 31st, 1998, with Todd Stottlemyre, noted hothead pitcher, for a player to be named later. That would be Mark Little. The players going to St. Louis, Darren Oliver and Fernando Tatis, one of the great baseball names. After a brief stint in Texas, he was there for 2.5 seasons. Then it was all free agent deals, 2001 and 2002 with the White Sox, 2003 in Milwaukee, 2004 in Colorado, 2005 in Arizona, 2006 splitting time between Washington and Cincinnati. He got traded in the Austin Kearns deal on July 13th, 2006. And then after finishing the 2006 season in Cincinnati, he would split time between Toronto and Boston in the 2007 season. In fact, he was released by the Rays in August of 2007. He signs with the Red Sox just a couple of weeks later, and he appears in only 8 games in the 2007 season. He has 6 plate appearances, 0 hits, 3 strikeouts. So his official line in the Boston Red Sox reads 8 games, 6 plate appearances, 1 run scored, but 3 strikeouts, a batting average of 0, an on-base percentage of 0, a slugging percentage of 0. And he was in the field for a handful of games in 2007 with the Red Sox. He played 3 games at third base, 1 game at shortstop. The other 3 games, he had a designated hitter appearance. Despite all these goose eggs on his line, he has a World Series ring because of it. It's the Red Sox, as you may recall, in 2007, winning the World Series once again, defeating the Colorado Rockies. And there you go. That's quite the way to end your career. Even though you've got a whole lot of flat lines on your stat line there, you appeared in just enough games, and you just happened to be picked up as a free agent by just the right team to win a World Series championship. So congratulations to him. Now, what has happened to Royce Clayton since then? Well, he has moved on to high school coaching. In fact, prior to the school year, I should say, at the end of August, he was named the head varsity coach at Oaks Christian School in California. So he is in charge of the high school and middle school baseball program. So that's excellent to see there. Also, he's been able to keep busy in the arts. And as I mentioned, this is something that you may actually know Royce Clayton for more in his career than his actual playing career. First of all, he is a movie actor. He appeared in 2 movies. Now, in the first movie, he actually isn't in the movie. He had an actor portray him. This was in the 2002 film The Rookie. He was portrayed by actor George Sanchez. It was in the 1999 time frame when Clayton was playing for the Texas Rangers. And, of course, this movie was all about the incredible story about Jim Morris. You probably know this, a guy who was a career minor leaguer in the 80s, became a high school baseball coach, and then the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, heartwarming story, signed him to a deal, and he actually played in the major leagues for a little over a year. So Royce Clayton was in a movie, but he wasn't really in the movie. Basically, there was an actor wearing his uniform, playing the part of the Texas Rangers shortstop at the time. Now, Clayton was actually in a movie, the Moneyball movie from 2011. He actually played the role of Miguel Tejada. How's that for creative license? The guy that never really hit the ball too hard. I'm trying to think, what was his career best for home runs? 14. He had 14 in both 1999 and 2000 with Texas, but he was good looking enough to be Miguel Tejada. So you've seen an actor portraying Royce Clayton, and then you've seen Royce Clayton portraying a much more powerful hitting Miguel Tejada in Moneyball. But you may not actually see what Royce Clayton is doing now. He is the founder of a company called Music Locker, and music is spelled M-U-S-I-Q. They make custom walk-up music for baseball players. You know, you've been to the stadium, player walking up to the plate, and there's some music playing. Most of the time, it's a well-known commercial rock song, hip-hop song, whatever. Well, he discovered that there were some players that wanted personal music made just for them. So he formed a company. He realized this as his playing career was winding down in 2007. And by the way, I found out about the story from Brad Balukjian. We had him on an earlier podcast talking about his adventures tracking down all the players in a pack of 1986 Topps wax pack that he opened up. So Brad Balukjian several years ago wrote in Rolling Stone about this. Clayton is wrapping up his career, trying to figure out what's next. And he talks to all these players and he discovers that some guys just want their own personal tracks. So Music Locker, which he founded, they make player walk-up songs. Now there's other projects that they do, but that was really the catalyst for what got him into the current business. And that is absolutely brilliant, because while it's great that he's coaching for a middle school and high school in California, you know, that's only going to pay so much. Music royalty fees, even for walk-up music, basically what happens is a professional sports team will pay ASCAP, and that's the licensing group that in turn pays artists for their songs. A team will pay ASCAP typically a flat number for a year. I don't know what that fee is because it varies from team to team, sport to sport. But let's just say it's not a couple dollars. You know, you're talking $10,000, $20,000, depending, again, on the sport and the usage. You know, obviously a baseball team is going to be using licensed music a lot more than a football team, which is only going to have maybe 8 home games, you know, perhaps 10 if they get into the playoffs. So there are fees that are given back to the songwriters and the composers that put together these songs. Now, like I said, most of the walk-up songs are commercial hit songs. You've heard them 1,000 times before. But for a project like this, if you think about it, let's say that Royce Clayton gets, just for easy math, 10 cents for every time a song is played. Well, if you've got a player with 500 plate appearances, let's just say, and 250 of them come at home, well, 250 plate appearances times 10 cents per play, that comes out to, what, about $25 a player. So if you have, let's just, again, just for easy math, this may not be accurate, but just for easy math, you have 100 players who are using this service, or you have 100 music tracks that are being used by several players, because maybe one player has 3 or 4 different tracks. So you take 25 and you multiply that by 100. Well, now you have $2,500. For what? For a song that you wrote or produced or composed maybe even 5-6 years ago. So, you know, you're getting a few thousand dollars easily just by walk-up music just coming right back into your pocket. So it's a very, very smart idea that Royce Clayton came up with. And good for him. Because, you know, again, he had a pretty serviceable career, 17 years in the big leagues. He made quite a bit of money off of it, too. You know, he wasn't a star player. The most he ever got paid in one season was $4.5 million. But according to baseballreference.com, his career earnings was just under $33 million. I think he can do just fine living off that money. But he made a good living as an athlete. He's making a good serviceable living right now as a teacher, as a baseball coach, and he's getting a little extra money by investing in a company that creates, among other things, walk-up music for baseball players. So there you go, Royce Clayton, a good shortstop, certainly not a great shortstop, nowhere near star status, but a guy who did, at the very end, win a World Series and made the transition from athlete to common citizen rather seamlessly. And that is a huge, huge problem for a lot of athletes in all sports. Clayton was lucky. He played Major League Baseball until he was 37. But there are a lot of players, a lot of quote-unquote average players, their careers are done at 27. Although I would have to say most sports, it's around 30. 30 is kind of the median age where if you're not a star, that's kind of where your pro career peters out. Well, a lot of the players in sports, because they've been playing the sport since they were 5 years old, so it's pretty much their entire life, all they've known is playing sports, 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 sports. And then all of a sudden, you know, when most people's careers are starting to ascend, you know, in the early 30s, that's typically when most people's careers start getting bigger job titles and bigger paychecks. Well, all of a sudden the athlete is done. And a lot of athletes, they don't know how to make that transition. So good on Royce Clayton for figuring out how to do it with a very long-term consistent source of income. It may not be a lot because, again, you know, music fees, you're only getting a few pennies on the dollar. Although, granted, you're charging your clients some money up front. That's where the real money is made. But the consistent money is in the rights fees. You're getting a few $1,000s a year from that. Good for you. So I don't know what education he got that the Giants paid for in 1990, as alluded to the back of his 1991 Upper Deck card here. But he certainly got educated along the way to figure out, A, I need to do something as soon as my career is done, and B, I should do it in the music business because that will slowly and surely pay me one song at a time. So there you go, Royce Clayton, card number 61 of the 1991 Upper Deck set, our random pull. Pretty entertaining story there for, again, a guy whose career, you know, you just look at the stats, it kind of falls by the wayside. But this guy made some very, very, very smart decisions all throughout his career and afterwards, which I really have to commend. That's a very smart guy there. Made some very good choices. So if you want to talk about him, you want to talk about 91 Upper Deck, you want to talk about some other finds you've made, or you want to bring up just a few more throwback uniforms, whatever's on your mind, let us know in our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and make sure you share the Twitter feed with your friends. Wax and Gum Stains is where we are 24/7. Wax Ecstatic Podcast comes out twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audio Boom and Twitter. And we certainly look forward to all of your comments. Now, we look forward to the next set, or do we? If 1991 Upper Deck was classy and sharp and beautiful, even though it was much of the same from the previous 3 years, 1991 Fleer, not so much. Unless you like bananas or rain slickers. Yes, the very yellow 1991 Fleer set. We'll take a look at it. We'll shield our eyes and we'll do a random pull like we always do. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to another edition of Wax Ecstatic.